The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Weekly from the Financial Times, back after the summer break. I'm Gideon Rachman. Today we're looking at Sweden, which is holding a general election this weekend amidst an unprecedented surge in support for the far-right Sweden Democrats. Joining me on the line from Stockholm, the Swedish capital, is our correspondent there, Richard Milne, and here in the studio, Europe editor Ben Hall. Richard, first, we're a few days away from voting. What are the opinion polls looking like?
The polls in some ways have been very consistent throughout. You've got the sort of centre-left bloc, which governs at the moment, which is on more or less 40%. The centre-right bloc is on 40%. And in between or on the extreme, you've got the anti-immigration Sweden Democrats on about 20%. So it's not clear who is which bloc is going to become the biggest. It's not quite clear, you know, how big the Sweden Democrats are, but the broad outline of the result is clear, and it's pretty clear that the Sweden Democrats are going to be a big winner.
So how big a development that is that in the history of modern Sweden? And give us a sense of the kind of essence of the Sweden Democrats, because we often read, and I'm sure it's true, that they have their roots in neo-Nazism. How far are those roots still showing?
So the Sweden Democrats were founded in the 90s out of a number of groups. Some of them came from the neo-Nazi movement to keep Sweden Swedish, and still is one of their slogans. And that is one reason why they're total anathema to the rest of Sweden politically. And I think that also hints at the, you know, how big a development this is, because in a way, what you're seeing in Sweden is just a very similar story to what you're seeing in the rest of Europe. But I think Sweden always had this status as rather different, you know, sort of self-styled humanitarian superpower, very generous welfare state. And I think it was felt to some extent it might be immune to some of the sort of populism that you saw elsewhere. And that's clearly not been the case, because the Sweden Democrats first entered into parliament only in 2010. Last elections in 2014, they became the third largest party. And in these elections, they could finish anywhere first, second, or third, depending on which poll you believe. But they're going to be much bigger, and it's going to be much harder for the political system to totally ignore them.
So, Ben, I mean, we heard there from Richard that this is obviously fits into a general European pattern. In a sense, could one almost argue that Sweden's late to the populist party, if you could put it that way, because you've had this, you know, populist already in government in Italy, anti-migrant populist in government in Italy, in Austria, the main opposition in Germany.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that's what makes it all the more remarkable and why it has such resonance in Europe and beyond, actually. As you say, many of the trends we're now seeing in Sweden, we've seen elsewhere: the collapse of the centre, or not quite the collapse, but the erosion of the centre, the difficulties of social democracy, and now the identity politics. I think what's so striking about Sweden is Sweden, for so many people, is a model of good governance, or seems to be a model of good governance and successful policy, and an economy that's managed to sort of reinvent itself and with it sustain a kind of generous social welfare system. So it seems all the more shocking in a way to see the rise of the far right in such a situation.
Although it's also true, isn't it, that Sweden stood out along with Germany as probably the most generous country towards refugees, and they have had a big inflow, yeah?
Absolutely. They took in, I think it was over 300,000 refugees in the 3 or 4 years up to 2015, you know, 3.5% of the population, huge numbers, with a open door policy, a bit like Angela Merkel's, which they then subsequently had to slam shut. And I think clearly part of the rise of the Sweden Democrats is because of the perceived failures of integrating these new immigrant newcomers, or at least the difficulty of doing so in a country like Sweden.
Yeah, and Richard, give us a sense of some of those difficulties, because you've certainly the Sweden Democrats and indeed nationalists as far away as the United States have made great play of the idea that there's kind of social turmoil in Sweden, particularly in big cities, associated with this wave of migration.
I think Sweden is, if not unique, close to, in the sense that it is a real battleground of ideas, possibly because of what Ben was talking about there, being this symbol. But the alt-right in the US and other countries has really adopted it. And you see media outlets like Breitbart and the Daily Mail sending, you know, enormous amounts of resources on covering Sweden. And what's been happening, I would argue, is probably Sweden has been going, has been catching up in some ways with elsewhere. But what there has been, there have been a number of shootings, arson attacks, burnt out cars. There have even been hand grenade attacks in which several people have got killed. And this is hugely shocking in Sweden, and has raised issues about whether they're integrating. I mean, I think what's also going on is that the Sweden Democrats were really the only party to be even slightly sceptical to immigration before 2015. And I think the rest of the political establishment is paying the price for really actually being quite naive ahead of 2015. The Prime Minister has admitted that Sweden was naive. And so the Sweden Democrats have, you know, in a way, gained credibility by being able to say, look, we told you so.
Let's say we return to the polling figures you cited earlier. Sweden Democrats at 20%. The other parties, as I understand it, have said they're going to not do any business with them, keep them out of government at all costs. Is that going to be practical? And even if it is, are they going to have to adjust to the kind of politics the Sweden Democrats represent in other ways?
I mean, it's the $64 million question. To put it in some context, last time round in 2014, the Sweden Democrats got about 13%. They essentially very nearly brought down the government. The government said they were going to announce new elections. It looked like Sweden was ungovernable. They managed to cobble together a compromise. That compromise has sort of fallen apart. That some parties on the centre-right would like to have not a cooperation with the Sweden Democrats, but open to being sort of implicitly supported from Parliament by Sweden Democrats. What's different in Sweden to elsewhere is they have a system of negative parliamentarism. So it just means that a government has to avoid having a majority against it. So if you can get the Sweden Democrats to abstain in return for promises maybe of slightly tougher immigration policy, then that's a way out. The door also opens potentially to something a bit more groundbreaking in Sweden, which would be some kind of grand coalition. That's what the ruling Social Democrats would clearly like to see. They'd like to pick off a couple of the smaller centre-right parties and have some kind of left-right government.
And Ben, I mean, returning to the broader European context, as we were saying, this is Sweden's a medium-sized country. It's not a big European country, but it's being watched very closely and it is part of a broader trend. Is there, do you think, any evidence of kind of populist international, if you like, of these different groups making common cause?
Well, there are certainly some people who imagine that a populist international is possible, like Steve Bannon, Donald Trump's former advisor, who has actually made it a sort of implicit aim to try and galvanize this populist nationalist front ahead of European elections next year. The thing is, there are many differences between these populist parties, and in some Some of them have already pledged not to work with others, and there are differences of view and differences of policy. So I think it would be difficult to see how they could coalesce in a single group. I think where they can coalesce, though, is in disrupting the way the EU works. And I think that's the biggest threat to Europe probably right now, apart from Brexit, that you can have people like Viktor Orban of Hungary, who doesn't want to take in any more refugees, for example, from the rest of Europe. And you have Matteo Salvini, who desperately wants other European countries to take in more refugees. They should be at odds with each other, and yet somehow they're making kind of common cause to challenge centralized sort of rule, if you like, from the EU, and that is going to cause the EU problems.
Because particularly on issues like migration, they need unanimity, essentially, to move forward, yeah?
Yes, essentially, they do. And also, what you have is just a sort of growing mass of disruptive forces in the EU, which is going to make governing the EU much, much harder.
Do we yet have a sense of what a ceiling for these populists are? Because, as Richard was suggesting, the Swedes are kind of later than others. We've seen the Danish People's Party, the True Finns in Scandinavia. They've almost become part of the political scenery. Do you think that the same thing could happen with the Sweden Democrats? It's just that you will now have a kind of nationalist party, but they don't tend to go above 20%.
I think there is a natural limit in modern democratic, still quite liberal Europe to the level of support for these parties, which is why you had many people last year in France who said the threat from Marine Le Pen's National Front was overblown, that there's a sort of natural limit to her support.
She got to 34, didn't she, in the presidential?
Yes, and then was never really going to get much beyond that. And obviously in the Nordic countries, they have different approaches to embracing or working with these countries, and in some places there's a feeling that actually if you work with the far right and bring them into power, then that's actually the best way of taming their political support, because you test their kind of populist policies against reality.
Yeah. And finally, Richard, coming back to you, but just give us before, ahead of the vote, a sense of what, if you like, politically aware people in Sweden, what they feel about this moment. It seems to me like a really big moment in Swedish modern history.
I think it's a huge moment for many people. It feels like a country that has been very self-confident is suddenly unsure of itself and some of its ideas. As I said, you know, self-proclaimed humanitarian superpower, suddenly wondering, you know, whether that is the right approach. And I think another issue is, though, that what most people agree is, no matter what the outcome, whether it's a left-wing government or a right-wing government that results, it will be an incredibly weak government, just as this current government is seen as the weakest in decades. And so a lot of people are actually rather worried about Sweden, as other European countries facing these questions about what you do with a aging population, how you adapt your welfare system to that, and the feeling that there's going to be a real lack of political will or ability to solve those kind of problems.
Okay, well, so as you say, even Sweden, well-run Sweden, has its big issues to face in the future. For the moment, though, thank you very much indeed to Richard Milne in Stockholm, to Ben Hall here in the studio in London. That's it for this week. Until next week, goodbye.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost £27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.